And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to be talking to an author in British Columbia who's written a wonderful book, Mrs. Queen's Chump. And his name is J.J. Hespeler Boltby. We'll be talking with him fairly shortly. At the halfway point, we're going to talk to the daughter of President Juvenal Habyarimana. Juvenal Habyarimana was one of the two African presidents assassinated on April the 6th, 1994, and the United Nations and no one else of any great power has bothered to investigate how two African presidents could have been murdered. That assassination led to the violence in Rwanda that was later labeled the genocide. But it started with the murder of those presidents. And at the tag end of the show, we're going to be talking with Stephen Gowans about this latest business with North Korea. But we are joined now, I believe, by J.J. Hespeler Boltby. Are you there, sir?
Right here.
Hey, thanks very much for joining us. Am I
talking to Phil now?
Yes, this is me.
Hey, how are you?
I'm stuck with it.
All right.
And listen, I'm going to tell you, first of all, I want all our listeners to know this is a terrific book, Mrs. Queen's Chump, and I get the full title, Idi Amin, the Mau Mau, Communists, and Other Silly Follies of the British Empire, a military memoir. And it's got a photograph on the cover that I better start with this. Did you take that picture that's on the cover?
Yes, I did.
Well, it's good evidence. I'm really glad you did. It is a very dramatic picture. Could you mind telling us what's going on in that picture?
It's quite a cover, isn't it?
It is.
Well, what would happen is that the army would swoop in and surround an entire village if there had been activity in the area, or if we were looking for Mama. These villages were protected. They themselves were surrounded by a fence and what's called a panji pit, which is a pit full of very sharp stakes stuck in the ground. So you can't get out of the village or into the village unless you go through the gate into the village, which is manned by policemen.
Mm-hmm.
And so the army would, if there was activity, we would swoop up, we'd surround the whole thing. And then we'd go inside and turn the place upside down. Hmm. Everybody would be turned out of their houses and shunted off into areas set up very quickly with barbed wire, like compounds. Men would be put in one, men and older boys, and the women and children would be put in another. And then one by one, these people would all be led up. Everybody in the village would be led before these two characters who looked like members of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes.
They were members, former members of the Mau Mau, who had turned loyal to the British, who had become loyal to the British. And so the British used them as informers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were usually from the same village. But of course, if they were recognized, they would be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so to avoid having them recognized, they were draped in these Ku Klux Klan-type shrouds. They'd be set in the back of a truck or at a table, mm-hmm. and then everybody in the village would be wheeled before them, brought mm-hmm. before them, and they wouldn't say anything. They weren't allowed to speak either, because if they spoke, their voices would be recognized.
They banged on the...
They would bang on the tailgate of the truck.
Oh, my.
If the guy was a Mau Mau, or associated with a Mau Mau in any way, they would bang on the tailgate of the truck, and then the police would swoop in and grab him and take him off, and that mm-hmm. would be chips for him.
Yeah, no, that's... It's very striking to see this. And, of course, by the way, I assume this was in Kenya. You also served a little bit in what was called Tanganyika, and you were, of course, in what is now Uganda. I don't know at the time.
I was not in Tanganyika myself mm-hmm. At that time. I've been to Tanganyika, but not in the military. I was in a Tanganyika battalion that was fighting in Kenya. There were Uganda battalions, Tanganyika battalions, fighting alongside the British in Kenya. There was a very strong military presence during the time of the emergency in Kenya.
Yeah, you point out they always have these words, the emergency, the troubles, the troubles.
These euphemisms, yeah.
And it was pretty rough medicine was being applied. You were, must have been, what, 20 years old, 20, 21?
I was 20.
Oh, my gosh.
I turned 20 when I came back to Canada.
So you were standing there in charge of, partly in charge of this operation in which people are being fingered and they may be killed, and you're 20 years old.
That's right.
You know.
It was a, you know, it was, I wasn't alone. I was with many other soldiers, officers doing the same, you know. And there were national service guys like myself, you know.
Yeah. But as you point out in your book, this is a young man trying to understand the world he's in and growing up, and these really shocking things are going on, and some of them he is having to take responsibility for.
Yes, yes, there's no question. I think I bring that out at the very end of the book, don't I?
Well, actually, I got to tell you, it's a very well-written book, but you know that. It's and you get that feeling because we go with you from being a public school boy with your brother, and then in the two of you part, and we sort of follow you. There's a sense of you're growing there. I think you changed that character the way a good playwright would. You know, you're supposed to learn something.
I appreciate the compliment.
This is Hespeler Boltby, and he was a young officer, served in Kenya, and against what was then called the Mau Mau, and it later was in Malaya and Singapore, and almost got into a fight with Nasser. You covered a lot of real estate. But on this first point of what happened in Kenya, does it twig your interest at all that some of these poor devils are now in court against the British for what was done to them?
Oh, very much so. In fact, I've been in touch with them.
Oh, I was. You're one step ahead of me. Because, you know, you're the perfect, you are the ideal kind of witness to these proceedings because, of course, they have an uphill battle. They say things happen to them. But on the other side, they're saying, well, it might have happened, but nobody gave an order, and we don't know anything about it, and the papers have been lost. But if there's an occasional British soldier, that might get more interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I wrote to them and alerted them to the book because I think the book tells the story. And I've heard back that they've received the information, and I guess they'll get in touch with me if they feel it's necessary. You know, I'm sure they have many fine witnesses. I don't think there's any shortage of witnesses to what was going on. You know, I wasn't witness to what's actually being investigated. What's being investigated are the concentration camps that the detention centers. Excuse me.
There are no concentration camps.
I better stay with the euphemisms.
Gathering points with barbed wire. Yes.
Yeah. But I wasn't witness to those myself. I learned later of their existence, you know. But I certainly saw the day-to-day stuff, you know, the treatment, and I could bear witness to the ambient of the entire situation and the out-and-out racism that existed, of course.
Well, there's a question I may as well ask you, too, right now. I mean, you, of course, you're characterizing the British Army. This is post-World War II. And as you point out, okay, our fathers fought in a real war. But now this is back to the old empire. And I mean, this we used to call these things expeditions and that sort of thing.
back in the days of Napier.
And
right?
Some of the officers you describe seem to be almost out of their minds. And I just want to ask you, doesn't empire lend itself to a kind of madness?
I hadn't actually thought of it like that, but I guess you're right. I mean, what I'm describing is a form of madness, I suppose.
Well, yeah. you certainly could. I mean, for example, you, maybe it's because of your mother, but you were you were turning things over in your mind, and every time you did that, you probably prevented yourself from going a little crazy. Because I mean, they were definitely, as I read your book, they were rationalizing their conduct based on race.
Well, that's what empire was, you know. I'm right, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. I know the better way to do things. Shut up and stand in line.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is what it's about.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly brutal.
Yeah.
Well, probably by the by, it would be to my financial advantage, you know, in some way.
Mm-hmm.
If I was an empire loyalist and you know.
Well, now, could you tell us, you had two experiences I thought were really emblematic ones, and I was very proud of you, the way you conducted yourself. You had wonderful soldiers serving with you who were African, and
yes.
They outstanding, and usually, of course, the old problem, they'd be a sergeant and you're the officer. And so you had the experience of respecting them and how they behaved, and then also fraternizing, and that led to a problem, didn't it?
It did, indeed, yeah.
Could you talk about that incident?
You want me to talk about it now?
Well, if you could, I mean, just how you felt about that. I mean, because what you describe is natural to me, but it got you in trouble.
It did. You know, the army that I was in, because I think it's changed now. I think there's a deal more sort of camaraderie between officers and men now in a volunteer army.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, in a sort of an empire army, the army itself had to be held in line by its senior officers.
Mm-hmm.
And in the days when racism was as rife as it was in Kenya at that time, there was certainly no mixing and matching with Africans. That was absolutely infradig. It was not permitted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And but you know, I was faced with the alternative of sitting every night in the officer's mess and getting drunk with these crashing Boers,
uh-huh.
or going down and enjoying myself listening to some damn good African drumming on the football field. And so that's what I did.
And some pretty good repartee. Was, I mean, those were good soldiers. It's
fantastic soldiers.
I mean, it's better to be with a good soldier than an old officer shooting his mouth off.
Well, you know, I'm describing an imperial army in the book. And I think it's probably very, very different now. You know, now that the empire is no longer, certainly not in its old context.
Mm-hmm.
So these old imperial officers, the guys themselves who had probably been in the Second World War, who had a sort of their minds made up about what they were doing in East Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, standing in line with racism, you know.
Yes. I just, actually, you know, I wonder, it strikes me that a lot of people who were best officer material would muster out the way you did, actually, when their time is up, whereas others don't really know what they're going to do with themselves, so they just stay on, and they're probably not the best fellows.
Well, yeah, you know, but the National Service officers were sometimes, you know, there was an attempt to recruit them to stay on, mm-hmm. as there was with me, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I described quite at some length this one particular officer. I've changed the names throughout the book, and I can't remember.
I assumed you did, or otherwise he'd want to duel with you.
Well, there was that one guy that I became friendly with, the one who took me into the forest to begin with in Kenya,
mm-hmm.
and who sort of trained me in how to move myself in the forest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was certainly a bit of a malcontent. You know, he'd woken up to the realities of his situation.
Was that the Australian?
But not many did that.
That was the Australian.
Sorry, he was Australian, yeah.
Yeah. By the way, I mean, I will get to that, I suppose, but I get the impression that you as a Canadian had some sort of maybe a cousin feeling for the Australian. Maybe he had the same for you. You didn't seem to be cut from the same cloth as the guys from Britain.
Well, you know, we were both treated as colonials.
Yes. A bloody colonial, I think they called you.
It was funny. I mean, it was funny in one way. It was kind of a, you know, it was funny the first time it happened, but after that it became a bit
less
boring,
funny.
You know.
It led to you making a wise remark, which I think was your downfall. You said you wondered if you were in the right army.
Well, that didn't help, did it?
I may as well just go to that. You had a reprimand, which I didn't understand all this. I was in the Marine Corps, but I didn't hear this kind of stuff. Two adverse reports, and they're ready to hang you.
Yes.
And you told, I think it's because you told two things. You told them you thought you might be in the wrong army, thinking better to be back in Canada. And then you didn't want to re-up.
Well, exactly. I didn't want to sign on,
mm-hmm.
and as the brigadier at the time said, you know, I ought to sign on if I want to clear my name. At that point, it wasn't very very important to me, you know,
mm-hmm.
to clear my name.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I felt I'd cleared my name simply by doing what I was asked to be doing. You know.
You were a very good soldier by this account. I have no reason to doubt you. This is Mr. Hespeler Boltby, by the way, and the title is Mrs. Queen's Chump, and the title comes out of the mouth of no less an authority than Idi Amin. We better have you tell. You actually ran into Idi Amin, as they say, when he was in the minors.
A corporal in the Uganda battalion of the King's African Rifles. And at one point in Kenya, the Uganda battalion was billeted with my battalion, the Tanganyika battalion,
mm-hmm.
Or some of them were. They were building themselves a new camp up on Mount Kenya. And so their battalion was split up. Half of them went off to build the camp, and the rest were billeted with the Tanganyika battalion. And when they were billeted with us, they were simply allotted so many soldiers to each platoon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to get Idi Amin. He was assigned to my platoon for, I don't know, about 6 weeks, I think.
And the two of you became boxers together.
Well, we were already boxers.
Yeah.
But
I hope you didn't hit him.
I wouldn't have dared do that. He was a much, much bigger man than myself. He was an enormous man. He was a very big man. And actually an extremely good boxer.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I was a fair boxer myself, but I was lightweight. He was very definitely heavyweight.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a damn good boxer. Watching him in the ring was quite a treat.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that I have seen very few boxers his equal.
Yeah, he probably had what it took in the sense that the way you describe him, if he'd had a trainer, manager, with speed and size, you can really go a long way as a fighter.
Oh, he was very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
He was very good.
And by the way, and you didn't have any, you didn't fault him as a soldier. You didn't see anything signs in him that he wouldn't have been a good soldier.
This was before he went on to greater things, right?
Mm-hmm.
He became a tyrant afterwards. But when I knew him, he was just a good soldier, and you know, it was quite a pleasure to work with him in some way, you know.
Sure. He mentioned his tribe, and then everybody else was he called Mau Mau, including you, right?
Right. Yeah.
What's his tribe?
He was Kakwa,
mm-hmm.
a small tribe in Uganda.
Apparently,
and mm-hmm. he was just joking. You know, he laughed a lot at his own jokes.
He had a good sense of humor. This is a great title, Mrs. Queen's Chump, describing you.
Well, he referred to the Queen as Mrs. Queen.
Yeah.
He would call her Mrs. Queen. And he kept on doing that. I mean,
and you were her chump.
After he became president of Uganda and started doing his terrible things, I understand that he continued to refer to the English monarch as Mrs. Queen.
Well, I think it's a pretty well known ill kept secret that we all kind of got a laugh behind our sleeve when we would do that. Even if we thought he was bad, we thought that's pretty clever.
Well, you know, I have this, I think I've described in the book my feelings about him. I think he was goaded and prodded. Yeah, I think he went mad, there's no question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you'd have to be something like that in order to do what he did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was, when he first became president of Uganda, he was hounded mercilessly by the British press.
Yeah.
For the jokes he made,
mm-hmm,
about the monarchy.
Yes, and
the British press did not appreciate that at the time, and they really took him to task on it. And I think one of the things that happened with him was that he never felt the respect that he never got the respect that he thought he should have had. When he became president. You know?
Speaking of military culture, with which you were obviously very well acquainted, that is a problem of people who were corporals and sergeants, right?
How do you mean?
They tend to think they're not getting their due. I speak as an ex-corporal, but I mean, there
should
is
always be a rank higher than me.
Well, they're not proper officers, right? I mean, they're in charge of men, but they're not, you know, entrusted.
Well, they're non-coms,
yeah,
I think they...
Not the real fellows.
Well, I don't know quite how to answer you on that.
Well,
I've never sort of climbed into their heads to ask them how they feel about it. You know? they're quite happy to get the little extra pay that they get,
yeah,
for the extra stripe on their arm. I'm sure of that.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with being a sergeant.
No, not at all.
I'm sure they won most of the actions.
But as they move on in life, if they get into politics, they will have a small chip there because everybody will know that they're not of the officer class.
There's the class difference, of course. Yeah,
yeah.
And they're very prominent, of course, in the British Army.
Yes, and you tell a good story. I want to come to in just one moment, but I'm going to ask you this. You leave a hanging story hanging. So I have to ask you, you end one of your chapters with an officer saying to you, I want to go to play golf this afternoon. I want you to go in my place to witness a hanging. But you don't say whether you went. Did you go and witness a hanging?
I left that out of the book on purpose. And I'm not going to answer you now either.
Oh, my gosh. Well,
there were many, many unpleasantries.
Between us, we can leaving that story aside. There were thousands of Kenyans hanged.
Yes, thousands.
Thousands.
Yeah,
and I'm really sorry for these gentlemen who are bringing the suit because it seems like it's a handful. But you know, there are multiplied thousands of families who lost somebody at the end of a rope. Not very pretty.
Yeah. Well, for a while there, the British were hanging them in public as well.
Yeah.
Which was, it was incredible. But anyway. Yeah.
Well, I better get you over to Singapore and Malaya because you also were there mm-hmm, fighting the communists in, they called them communist terrorists in what was then called Malaya. I used to know people from Malaya, and now I have to call them from Malaysia. They don't seem to mind. You were involved in Singapore in particular. You tell a pretty nasty story. And actually, you make me care about people, so I have to ask you this question. You were running a Wellington-style square up a street, and you had it. Mm-hmm. If anybody got into your interior of the square that you were clearing, using this block to clear the street of demonstrators, if they got inside, they would then be beaten to a pulp. And I got the impression some people might have been killed that way. You tried to save a life. You tried to save a woman and her child. Did they die? What happened?
Quite honestly, I saw them out of the square because they would have been killed if they'd stayed in the square. So
But didn't you see them after?
I shepherded them out at the back of the square.
Mm-hmm.
My attention was up at the front, was called back to the front right away, so I had to go to the front of the square, but I shepherded them out at the back of the square.
Mm-hmm. But didn't you see them down afterwards? Didn't an officer say to you, why did you let them Why did you try to help them out of the square?
Yeah, because I was at the front of the action, mm-hmm. right? Behind me, there were other troops.
Mm-hmm.
And so presumably, they were killed after they got out of the square.
Ah. That is one of the again, it's a powerful book, and it captures this very nicely. Now, you got in hot water and almost, frankly, in my opinion, you were railroaded out of the service, actually, for virtually nothing. Here you were doing a job which was quite rough, and in which people were, civilians were ending up dead. And for which, by the way, you should get full credit as a soldier. You're doing what you're supposed to do. But they don't. None of you get in hot water for that. I found that a paradox of sorts.
Yeah, well, the British have never paid any pensions to any national servicemen,
mm-hmm.
officers or other ranks. They just didn't pay. They haven't paid pensions to them.
Yeah.
All that period of national service after the war, up until, from the end of the war until 1961, it was called national service. And if you were a national service man,
mm-hmm.
no pension. You were simply doing your presumed duty
mm-hmm.
For Queen and country, you know?
Yes.
No acknowledgement whatever. That.
Now, it strikes me, reading your book, that actually they owe you something. And unfortunately, they did push you a little too much, and so you decided you would show them. So you came back to Canada and became a proper officer in a better operation, I take it.
Well, I came back and joined the Canadian Army. Mm-hmm. But I was sort of bamboozled into resigning my commission in the British Army.
Mm-hmm.
And when I discovered that, in fact, I had been bamboozled, I immediately signed on in the Canadian Army and got my commission back again.
Yeah.
So, in fact, under that system, as an officer in the Canadian Army, even had I been somehow recalled to England to serve in the British Army, I would have served as an officer.
Yeah.
You understand? The Queen's Commission is the Queen's Commission.
Yeah.
But the whole matter is moot, really.
Yeah.
It was when I got back to Canada, my feelings were hurt and my head was scrambled. So.
Yes. By the way, everything you went through would qualify you for what if the way you felt. I think is what you call the old fashioned word, which I appreciate, shell shock. Now they call it post traumatic stress. But, you know, from the day you walk in there and start being pushed around by sergeants and whatnot, all of that can lead to this so-called post-traumatic.
I don't think any man who joins an army or a military unit and has a sergeant shouting at him from 3 inches in front of his nose comes away unaffected.
It
has that effect.
Amen to that. I want to tell everybody, this is J.J. Hespeler Boltby, and the book is Mrs. Queen's Chump, Idi Amin, the Mau Mau, Communists, and Other Silly Follies of the British Empire, a military memoir. And I want to tell you, if you could tell us a quick love story here and the class system. You, on a ship coming home, met a nice young woman. But your commanding officer took you aside and explained to you not to talk to her. You want to tell us about it quickly?
Oh, God. Well, that's an old story, and my wife is right here. I better be careful.
but I can't get you out of this now. It's too late.
I fell in love with a girl on board the ship. Very easy to do when you have a long ship's voyage and there's a pretty girl there.
Mm-hmm.
She was a wonderful kid, but she was the... She was the daughter of a service. He wasn't her father was in one of the service regiments. He wasn't of a line regiment. I was in a line regiment, which was mm-hmm. Considered very very posh.
Mm-hmm.
And so the commanding officer on board the ship said that I was too high on the social scale for this girl. Well, I mean, you know, it was just nonsense. I ignored it.
Yes, that's what a lovely part of this book.
that bloody colonel.
Well, you've turned all of us against him, so I hope everybody gets this book.
Well, poor guy is probably turning over in his grave now, yes. God knows.
Well, Mr. Hespeler Boltby, we really appreciate your taking the time, and maybe we could talk to you in the future about the Mau Mau trials.
Well, you know, we'll see what happens there. Nobody's contacted me, of course, but if they do, you'll certainly hear about it.
Yeah, we want to follow up on, you know, how it all goes through, and we might get tell some more stories, because people need to know what happened there in Kenya.
Yeah, it was a bad time.
Well, it's a good book. Thank you very, very much.
Okay. Bye-bye. Nice talking to you.
Bye-bye.